That's when Schaefer writes on political issues, pretty easy to understand.
What's happening in the race is really good.
The, yeah, and we got the video page for that. It's really diving right with it. The Schaefer stuff that's real, it's more difficult, is just the God who is there, he is there and he is not silent, and the escape from reason. They're a little tougher to understand.
Is it going to be a little bit better?
Yeah, yeah. If you read Geisler's philosophy of religion, it's right around the same level, only not as academic. It's more discussional type. Okay, lecture number 10, philosophy of religion. We're on the Kalam cosmological argument. And I want to just talk about a little bit about actual infinite sets. And I talked with Moreland on this, both J.P. Moreland and William Lane Craig, in their apologetic text, Moreland, Scaling the Secular City, and in Craig, Apologetics and Introduction, they state categorically that the impossibility of an actual infinite set. Yeah. And that's why I called Moreland and said, hey, I think there's a problem with that, because if God is omniscient, even though he knows everything in one eternal glance or one eternal thought, he still has access to an actual infinite set of things that he knows, even though he knows them all in one thought. And I've even heard Greg admit to that point in San Francisco at a meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society a few years ago. By the way, there's a meeting coming up in Multnomah in April 8th on Saturday, and they'd like to see. I'm proposing a paper, do a paper on Blaise Pascal, and the whole thing will probably cost $12 for the whole day, including your lunch and stuff. So if you guys want to attend, let me know. I'm going to be going down there. That'll be real good. So I think they're arguing for too much. And what Moreland told me was that I suggested that we should only argue just for the impossibility of traversing an actual infinite set, because that's all we need to prove the end of the universe. He agreed that's all we need, but then he suggested that there might be another way that we could argue against it, and that is that the only way an actual infinite set could exist would be in the abstract realm of ideas, and not in the concrete realm of existent beings, okay, that exist outside the mind, that have existence outside the mind. Now, that's not just, we don't just say that because it sounds real good and it fits our view. By the way, abstract ideas exist where? In minds. Well, the only mind that's going to have an actual infinite number of ideas has got to be an infinite mind. Okay? So that's the only place an actual infinite that exists, is in an infinite mind, is in God's mind. But the reason why concrete things like Bonaventure, this is really rocky, because Bonaventure brought up, he used bad science. I'm going to use Bonaventure science, okay? This is still at a time when they thought that the sun was going around the earth. Okay, so this is a class in philosophy of religion. It's got nothing to do with science, right? So forgive Bonaventure here, because this is good philosophy, but it's horrible science. Okay, he said it takes, for every one time that the sun goes around the earth, is what he said. Of course, he was wrong there. I want everybody on listening to the tape and calling me up and trying to explain to me that the Earth goes around the sun. But Bonaventure thought the sun goes around the Earth. He said, for every one time that the sun goes around the Earth, the moon goes around the Earth 12 times. Okay? Because, 12 months to a year. Okay? So he said that if the universe is eternal, then the sun went around the earth an infinite number of times, and the moon went around the earth an infinite number of times, so they both went around the earth an equal number of times, an infinite number of times. Yet, the moon went around the earth 12 times as many times as the sun did. So there's a contradiction there. So he said, therefore, there had to be a first time that the sun went around the earth and that the moon went around. Good philosophy, lousy science. But another
of them doesn't require much modification to bring it up to speed.
And I tried doing it because it takes like something like, what, Mercury goes around the sun like three times
in 2 years.
And so I worked it out where you could do it, but it just doesn't sound as great as... Craig uses the illustration of black books and red books. He had a library where you had an infinite number of red books and an infinite number of black books. You have all kinds of contradictions. For one thing, if you took all the red books out and take a whole infinite number of books out of there, take all these red books out, you still got an infinite number of books because you got an infinite number of black books there. Then if you took one red book from the red books, you still have an infinite. An infinite minus one is still an infinite. But if you added another red book to there, it wouldn't be any higher. It's still infinite. You can do this with number lines if you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all whole numbers on and on infinitely. That's set A. Set B, let's just take the odd numbers. 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, on and on infinitely. They're both equal sets because they're both infinite. Yet set B has only half of the members of set A. So how can they be half? How can it have half the members, yet the same number of members? Well, the answer is they could only exist in the possible realm and be potentially infinite, not in the actual realm. Not if they were like pieces of chalk. One would just be twice the size of the other, but they would not be infinite. They would be finite sets. So whenever you break down and try to have an actual infinite set in the concrete realm, things that exist outside the mind, you run into contradictions. Therefore, it's impossible for there to be an actual infinite set of concrete things, things which exist outside the mind. But the only place where an actual infinite set can exist is in the abstract realm of ideas, and the only place you're going to have an infinite number of ideas is in an infinite mind. That's the only place that ideas exist, in the mind, and the only mind that could have an infinite set of ideas would be an infinite mind. So that's kind of all the back in there, but all we need, you don't have to get into all this mumbo jumbo, all we need to show is that it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set, which is what Zeno showed, Zeno's paradox, where to get from point A to point B, you got to get halfway first. But before you can get from point A to that halfway point, you got to get halfway. And before you can get from point A to that halfway point, you got to get halfway. And movement never gets started if there's an actual infinite set of points between point A and point B. In actuality, you know, there's only a finite set. But what he's showing, though, is if there is an infinite set of points, you can't traverse it. You can't cross it. But what does that tell us about God's knowledge? If God knows an infinite number of things, that throughout all eternity we'll never even know a fraction of it. Okay? And because you can't divide an infinite.
Do you know how people pretend to defeat that argument that you can't cross an infinite? Well, I'm reading a book right now by Frank Lerner, who is supporting an eternal universe. And he's always creating all kinds of science and fancy math to back it up.
There's two books, and Craig's apologetic for which came out again, he's putting back in print. I get Craig's and Moreland. They're the two leading guys that that use the cosmological argument. And Craig scaling the secular sin, but keep in mind that they argued for too much in both of those books, and they would probably change, I know Moreland would change it if it came out again. You know, it's still in print, but I mean, if they did it in an updated version, he would probably change it. And, but both of them deal with objections to it. I think Craig gets right into infinite set theory. But again, it's still not a whole lot of pages spent on it. But,
probably good after going into the secular half and finding it.
Yeah, but one of the problems that you have, though, whenever you go into like secular scientific writings or secular math writings, a lot of times there's a hidden premise. And the hidden premise is, whenever we do science, we must either believe that God doesn't exist, or at least assume that He doesn't exist, in order to do our science. And with that hidden premise, a lot of times what you're saying is, we know this sounds ludicrous, but it has to be this way. And what's left unwritten is, because the only alternative is that God existed and did it this other way. So, you know, it's like a college textbook. They say that all existing cells have come from pre-existing cells. And then it says, of course, this doesn't apply to the first. The original cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. Well, why do they assume that? Well, because they assume that there's no living God. No God who created the first cell. Therefore, where else could the first cell come from if there was nothing but non-living material? Since from nothing, nothing comes, it had to come from there. So that just pushes everything back more. It makes that there's no explanation for how it could happen. They just violated one of the scientific laws that they just defined. They define it, and they violate it right before. And so well, this, of course, is the first time the first cell had to have come from non-living material. So if that could happen once, it could happen 12 times today, for all you know. And so that's the only thing I would say there is, I would find a guy who, whatever the field is an expert in that field and has a vibrant Christian faith. Every once in a while, you'll find a Christian philosopher or scientist who lives in two stories, his Christian faith and his philosophy or science, and never the two shall meet. And that's hogwash, but if you find a guy who his science is goes hand in hand with his Christian belief, that they can help you through a lot of stormy travel and save a lot of
water.
With the heavy mark, I would also recommend too, even though I salute the heavy mark and I get a little frustrated with you, Ross. It's also good to get the other creations who are the old Earth type. I could even see the possibility of an old universe, so long as nothing that the Bible would classify as a living being came into existence until very shortly before then. Like, I cannot see. I just have a theological problem with any kind of physical death before the fall. Now I can see Adam and Eve eating animals, eating plants, plant life before the fall, but with science, the Bible the Bible doesn't know where the Bible says that a tree is a living being. Living being even implies the existence of a soul, even an animal, even though it doesn't, the Bible doesn't teach that animals have life after death.
What is spirit?
What?
It's spirit.
Well, the word that is used of them is soul. Yeah, and in fact, even when in Genesis, the early chapters, where it talks about the animals having being living beings, literally in the Hebrew it's living souls. And some of the translations were translated literal. And that's the problem with even with the Greek and the Hebrew almost identical when it comes to the word soul, which it can be either wind, breath, or spirit. It should be either wind, breath, or spirit. like ruach in the Hebrew and pneuma in the Greek, but then also in the Hebrew for soul, what is it? Is it nefesh? I can't remember. Anyway, don't quote me on it. In the Hebrew, the word for soul, just like the word for soul in the Greek, psuche, it can be either soul or life. And when King Herod sought the soul of Jesus, obviously he sought the life of a little child, Christ, little Christ child. But sometimes it was either way. You're going to change the whole meaning if you choose the wrong one. And so I think in those cases, it should just be left as soul, and then let everybody else, you know, interpret it for themselves, whether it means life in that context or not. But getting back to the Kalam cosmological argument, whatever had a beginning needs a cause, the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. And then we might say, well, what about the cause of the universe might have a cause, and that might have a cause before, and on infinitely. Well, you can't have an infinite regress, because if you had an infinite regress throughout all eternity, you would never have reached the present effect, the universe. And so an infinite regress is impossible, so there has to be an eternal, uncaused cause of the beginning of the universe. And again, William Lane Craig and J.P. Moore are modern proponents of this. Francis Schaeffer has an interesting cosmological argument in, I think in both the God who is there and he is there and he is not silent. He says basically there's only three possible explanations for what we now recognize as the existence. One is that everything came from nothing. Second possibility is that everything had an impersonal start. The third possible explanation is that everything had a personal start. Now, the first possibility, everything came from nothing, is bogus, because from nothing, nothing comes. The second thing, that everything had an impersonal start, Schaeffer argues that personal man could not come from an impersonal cause. And therefore, Schaeffer argues that everything had a personal start. It's a real simple argument, but Schaeffer has a way of saying simple things in such a way that they sound so profound that they penetrate the heart. When I debated Dr. Peter John in my opening statement, I used a couple arguments for God's existence. I'd like to read some of this. It's going to have to be a couple let me just read this. The common ground and the Thomistic argument from existential causality, you can see how they would flow not just with the as a syllogism but as an argument. I argue that it is my belief that one space should be based upon the evidence. Though I believe in the existence of the God of the Bible, I do not believe that his existence can be proven with mathematical certainty. However, one can argue that God's existence from premises that are beyond reasonable doubt. The denial of these premises is absurd, forced, and temporary. Therefore, God's existence can be proven with a high degree of probability. For example, when we drive our vehicles over cement bridges hovering hundreds of feet above waterways, we have faith that these bridges will support the weight of our vehicles. This is not blind faith. for there is much evidence that man's technology is capable of building these structures. Our faith is based on the available evidence, though certainty eludes us. In like manner, the belief in God's existence can be proven with a high degree of probability. It should also be noted that a person may know something to be true, though he or she may not be able to prove it. A suspect in a crime may know he is innocent, yet not be capable of proving it. Many Christians know that God exists, but they cannot prove that he does. Having said this, I will now begin my case for the existence of the God of the Bible. First, we must briefly define our concept of God. By God, I mean the eternal being that has caused the existence of everything else that exists. This eternal being is an intelligent and moral being. Whatever attributes he has them to an infinite degree. Second, we must find common ground between deists, those who believe in God's existence, and non-theists. From this common ground, we will build our case. We will examine four areas of common ground. First, the law of non-contradiction says that something cannot be both true and false at the same time in the same way. If something is true, then its opposite must be false. If the non-theist tries to deny the law of non-contradiction, he must first assume it to be true in order to make the denial. Otherwise, the opposite of the denial could also be true. Second, the law of causality states that everything that has a beginning needs a cause. To reject this principle is absurd. If the law of causality is not true, then something could be caused to exist by nothing. However, nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, hence nothing can cause nothing. Also, if one rejects the law of causality, then there is no basis for scientific experimentation. The modern science must assume this principle when attempting to discover the relationships that exist between the elements of the universe. The principle of analogy teaches us that two effects that are similar often have causes that are similar. For instance, a watch shows tremendous design and complexity. So does the universe. In fact, a single-celled animal has enough genetic information to fill an entire library. Therefore, it seems reasonable to conclude that since it takes an intelligent being to make a watch, it must also have taken an intelligent being to design the universe. It seems rather unlikely that we could get enough information to fill an entire library merely by chance. Intelligent design is needed. Finally, the basic reliability of sense perception is accepted by theists and non-theists alike. Though we can sometimes be mistaken in the conclusions we draw from what our senses perceive, our sense perceptions can usually be trusted. We see someone throwing a rock at us, we duck and remove ourselves from danger. We hear the whistle of a coming train, we stay clear of the railroad tracks. And of course, modern science must assume the basic reliability of sense perception in order to examine nature. My case for God's existence will be built upon the laws of non-contradiction, causality, and analogy, as well as on the basic reliability of sense perception. Both theists and evolutionists must hold to these four areas of common ground. If a person verbally denies these principles, he must still live like they are true. And then I go into the Thomistic argument from existential causality. My first argument for God's existence derives its substance from Thomas Aquinas' five ways to prove God's existence. Experience shows us that limited dependent beings exist. These limited dependent beings need other beings for their continued existence. For example, I depend on air, water, and food to sustain my existence. However, adding limited dependent beings will never give us an independent and unlimited whole. Therefore, the sum total of limited dependent beings is itself limited and dependent. Hence, the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of all limited dependent beings must be unlimited and independent. There cannot be two or more unlimited and independent beings, since if there were, they would limit one another's existence. But then they would not be unlimited. Therefore, there can only be one unlimited and independent being. This being must have all its attributes in an unlimited way. Otherwise, it could not be an unlimited being. This being must be all-powerful, for he is the source of all the power of the universe. No other power can limit him. He is eternal, for he is not limited by time. He is everywhere present, since he is not limited by space. He is immaterial, since he is not limited by matter. His being must also be all good, since he is not limited by evil. He must also be unlimited in knowledge. Since mindless nature works towards goals, such as acorns always becoming oak trees and not something else, there must be an intelligent designer overseeing natural processes. Without intelligent design, nature's processes would be left to chance. There would be no orderly patterns that could be described as natural laws. Therefore, this infinite and independent being that all finite and dependent existence depends upon for its continued existence must be an intelligent being. After that, I went into the Kalam cosmological argument of St. Bonaventure. I don't want to go over the different... what I'll do is I'll give you an overview of the... what I'd like to do is read... Got a few minutes. Let me just read this. I wanted to say some time for questions. I don't know if I'm going to be able to, but let me read through this argument. There are a few changes that need to be made to it because this was back at the time when I was still arguing for the impossibility of an actual infinite, but we'll get to that early when we get there. My second argument is based upon the argumentation of St. Bonaventure. Whatever began to exist must have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. Since the universe began to exist, it must have a cause. There is much evidence for the beginning of the universe. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, and the Big Bang model. I would use the Big Bang model primarily, because I'm not quite as convinced about it as I used to be, but I would use it primarily as we'll take what they give us and use it against them type of thing. Because the Big Bang model, if it proves anything, it proves the beginning of the universe. The second law of thermodynamics is one of the most firmly established laws of modern science. It states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. This means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless. In other words, if left to itself, the universe will have an end. But if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. If the universe is winding down, then it must have originally been wound up. The universe is therefore not eternal. It had a beginning. Since it had a beginning, it needs a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. The Big Bang model also teaches us that the universe had a beginning. In 1929, astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding at the same rate in all directions. As time moves forward, the universe is growing apart. But this means that if we go back in time, the universe will be getting smaller and smaller. Eventually, if we go back far enough in the past, the entire universe would be what scientists call a point of infinite density. This marks the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang. By the way, a point can only be finitely dense. If it's infinitely dense, it means it's small in an infinite manner, which basically means it's non-existent. So scientists don't like to say that the universe came into existence out of nothing, which basically the Christian believes that God created the universe out of nothing. The scientist doesn't like that, so he calls it a point of infinite density. They've also referred to it as a point of dimensionless space. And a singularity the Christian would agree with, because the creation only happened once.
Singularity as it only happened once? Because they believe, science believes that there are singularities in existence today. Black holes, for instance, contain singularities.
But they would view that as like a specific singularity. And in other words, with the Big Bang, those who reject an oscillating model will give good reasons for that. They would hold it as a singularity in that it occurred once. Yeah. And which, by the way, shows the scientific model only deals with operation science because it has to deal with processes that are that can be observed.
Right.
And singularities can't be observed since they only happened once in the past. Singularity would be, you know, there's millions and millions of murders that occur. Each murder has to be handled as a singularity because that each murder only occurred once. And forensic science deals with what guys with more origin science reconstructing through circumstantial evidence what actually occurred. Okay, this marks the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang. There have been two main attempts to refute the beginning of the universe. The first is the steady state model. This view holds that the universe never had a beginning. Instead, it always existed in the same state. Because of the mounting evidence for the Big Bang model, this view has been abandoned by most of its adherents. The second attempt to evade the beginning of the universe is called the oscillating model. This model teaches that at some point during the universe's expansion, gravity will halt the expansion and pull everything back together again. From that point, there will be another Big Bang. This process will be repeated over and over again throughout all eternity. Unfortunately, the oscillating model fails. First, there is no known principle of physics that would reverse the collapse of the universe into another Big Bang. Second, current scientific research has shown that the universe is not dense enough for gravity to pull it back together again. And third, even if it could be proven that several Big Bangs have occurred, the second law of thermodynamics would still require that there was a first Big Bang. You know, eventually, there'd be a last one, and we'd run out of energy, and there'd be a final one. Besides the scientific evidence, there is also philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. For if the universe is eternal, then there would be an infinite number of events in time. However, as Zeno's paradox has shown, it is impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of points. Assuming that an actual infinite set of points exists, before one can move from point A to point B, one must reach the midpoint. When moving from point A to the midpoint, however, one must reach the midpoint between those two. It goes on and on. I'll skip down a little bit. So movement never occurs. Thus, Zeno's paradox shows us the impossibility of traversing an actual infinite set of points. Now, Zeno concluded, by the way, that therefore movement is impossible. Aquinas would say, no, obviously movement is not impossible, it occurs all the time. What is impossible is for there to be an actual infinite set of points between point A and point B. There's only a finite number of points. Now, you can divide things infinitely, but that just shows that there's a potential infinite between two points, but not an actual infinite. You can only put an actual number, a finite actual number of tens, of actual things, tens, in between point A and point B. So it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of points. If the universe is eternal, then there must exist an actual infinite set of events in the past, but then it would be impossible to reach the present moment. Since we have reached the present moment, we know that there were only a finite set of events in the past. Therefore, there was a first event. The universe had a beginning. It should also be noted that if it is possible for an actual infinite set of concrete things to exist, contradictions and absurdities would be generated. We've talked about the different sets. It would with odd and even numbers, an infinite set with odd and even numbers would be equal to an infinite set with just even numbers, which again would be twice as large as it, and that would be violate the law of non-contradiction. Therefore, there had to be a first event. The universe had a beginning. Since the universe had to have a beginning, it had to have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. But if the universe needs a cause, what if the cause of the universe also needs a cause? Could we not have an infinite chain of causes and effects stretching backward in time throughout all eternity? Obviously, the answer is no, but we've shown that it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set. Therefore, there had to be a first uncaused cause of the universe. This uncaused cause would be eternal, without beginning or end. Only eternal and uncaused existence can ground the existence of the universe. This was on a debate, and I stated, this debate hopefully is evidence that intelligent life exists in the universe. Since intelligence is found in the universe, the ultimate cause of the universe must also be an intelligent being. For intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence. No one has ever shown how intelligence could have evolved from mindless nature and get intelligence from a rock. By the way, anything that you find in the universe, the only way you could posit it to an infinite being would be if it's something that is possible that it could exist infinitely. For instance, evil can only exist as a perversion of that which is good, so there's no such thing as infinite evil. So you couldn't say, well, there's evil in the universe, therefore God has to be evil. Morality also exists in the universe. Without morality, there could be no such thing as right and wrong. But the moral judgments we make show that we do believe there is such a thing as right and wrong. But nature is non-moral. No one holds a rock morally responsible for tripping it. Since nature is non-moral, but morality exists in the universe, the cause of the universe must be a moral being. The moral law is not invented by individuals, for individuals judge the actions of others. If morality is relative, no one could call the actions of Adolf Hitler wrong. Nor could society be the cause of moral law, since society often pass judgment on one another. Only an absolute moral lawgiver who is qualitatively above man can be the cause of a moral law that stands above man and judges his actions. Therefore, the uncaused cause of the universe must be an intelligent moral being. This means that God must be a personal being. I used another argument, more kind of more like along the lines of Norman Geisler, but yeah, and by the way, all these things are, if you notice, I'm ending up the cosmological arguments here with moral arguments and teleological, and finding intelligence or finding design. You can even teleological arguments by finding intelligence in the universe, or by finding design in the universe, or by finding that mindless nature moves towards goals in the universe, which is a different way of finding design in the universe. But after arguing that the eternal, uncaused cause of everything else that exists must be an intelligent and moral being, a personal being, I used a couple of premises like this. As the source of all else that exists, this eternal, uncaused cause must be unlimited in all its attributes. For instance, the uncaused cause must be all-powerful, since he is the source of all the power in the universe. No other power can limit him. He must be all-knowing, since he is the source of all knowledge. All knowledge comes from him. He must be sovereign, for as creator, he cannot be mastered by his creation. He must be all-good, because he is the source of all the good in the universe, he is not limited by evil. He must be perfect, because he is the standard by which all else is measured. He is immaterial, because he is not limited by matter. He cannot be limited by anything, so he must be immaterial. He must be omnipresent or everywhere present, because he cannot be limited by space. He must be eternal, because he cannot be limited by time. And he must also be one, because two infinite beings, if there was more than one infinite being, if there were two infinite beings, they would limit one another, but this is impossible, since to be infinite means to be unlimited by any other being. You couldn't have... The door's closing by itself. But you couldn't have two infinite gods who could arm wrestle to a draw, like, which is metaphysical dualism, like in Zoroastrianism, the Persian religion, that there's an all-good God and an all-evil God in there. Wrestling to a tie. Also, for two beings to differ, one being must have something that the other one lacks. But if one being lacks some perfection, then he cannot be infinite. So therefore, only one infinite being can exist.
because for them to differ in any way, one of them's got to lack what the other one has. Also, as the source of all finite existence, the eternal uncaused cause must be immanent, that means involved with his creation, and transcendent, which means separate from his creation, which the theist argued for. God is immanent in that he must sustain all finite existence, for what cannot cause its own existence can't keep itself in existence. Okay, I'll give you an analogy that breaks down, but just supposing I said, okay, Jack, you don't deserve it. There's no way for you to earn it, but I'm going to give you the heavyweight championship of the world belt right now. So you didn't earn it. You received it, and you didn't earn it for yourself. Now all you got to do is step in the ring with George Foreman and keep it. Well, if you couldn't get yourself the title in the first place, chances are you're not going to be able to keep it. Now, the analogy obviously breaks down because George Foreman is not infinite. He's only finite. He's going to seem like he's infinite, and so he's not. So God must be infinite. He must sustain all finite existence and keep it in existence. For what cannot cause its own existence cannot keep itself in existence. And then God must also be transcendent, because he is infinite, but his creation is finite. Therefore, he is not identical to the universe, but he is the cause of the beginning of the universe and the cause, the sustaining cause that keeps the universe in existence. That's about it.
I just want to say one thing. Early on in your introduction, you said that modern science has to assume the basic reliability of sense perception in order to examine nature.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm finding as I'm reading more about astronomy and cosmology in an attempt to figure out Big Bang and other things, more and more cosmologists are getting away from examining nature at all. They've taken Einstein's equations and people like Fermi and, I don't even know if all the names off the top of my head right now, but Oppenheimer, they take all the equations and they take them into their little computers, and they don't deal with observation anymore, and they even pride themselves somewhat on being above mere observation.
Yeah.
And especially when observation contradicts their theory.
The problem with science is that science doesn't exist in a vacuum. There has to be some rules.
Cosmologists believe that they do exist in a vacuum.
Well, what I'm getting at is without a religion or a philosophy of life that has determined the guidelines and the rules, and basically, in a general sense, what the universe is, you can't even begin to look at the particulars. So modern science was founded on the premise of Christianity, that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way so that through reason man could find out about the elements of the universe. Well, when the atheist threw out the God of the Bible, he tried to keep going through the motions, and that broke down on him. So now scientists have to get a new religion just to keep modern science going. And if they don't want to accept the God of the Bible, the only alternative is the God of the New Age, the only viable alternative. But the problem with that is you accept the God of the New Age and things can happen without a cause. Things don't have to make sense anymore. And so modern science, instead of the honest investigation of nature, it has slowly evolved into just basically a big, it's going to become in the near future, it's already getting there, it's going to become just basically a big religious superstition. In fact, they've shown the magic is the attempt to master nature, and science is almost like the same exact definition. And what's happening is any science without God eventually will break down into superstition, magic, and myth, and that's what we're coming with. And the future of modern science, as opposed to Christian modern science, is going to be New Age pantheism, and so that's the direction we go. We see quantum physics going that way in leaps and bounds.
The second question, you said that God is transcendent and immanent, all in everyone. And what is the need for salvation if God is only transcendent and immanent, meaning in the sense? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the thing is, though, it's like the scriptures teach that the Antichrist and false prophet are going to, or those who set the mark of the beast are going to burn in hell forever in the lake of fire in the presence of the Lamb and his angels. So God has a, God is everywhere present by his nature, but that doesn't mean that he's present with Lucifer and those in hell in his fellowshipping presence. But when the Holy Spirit comes into a believer, it's a personal relationship, it's a fellowshipping presence. So God is everywhere present in his essence by nature, but that says nothing about in terms of salvation. That just says in basically the way things are. And but for a fellowshipping presence, it's totally different. That'd be like saying, if you and I are walking down the street and I'm taking you to the gallows to be hung, and you're handcuffed and I'm the guard who's got to make sure that you get hung, I could say I'm with you 100%. Now, what I might mean is just that I'm with you 100% and I'm making sure that you're not leaving. And I'm just walking with you 100%. Or I could be saying,